Hooray and hallelujah. You know, it's pretty remarkable. I started out in Florida the first few years, and I did a lot of really tough one-night gigs, and I worked with some really amazing comedians. One guy I worked with several times was Jeff Foxworthy, and I actually didn't have a car, and he gave me a ride a few times, and I was a young comedian, and I asked him a bunch of advice because he was the elder, and I got to sit down with him on the stage at the Atlanta Punchline and do a little chat with him. We talked about his greatest triumphs as a comedian. I got to confront him about a long-standing issue that my mother has held against him. And it was a pretty historic time in the man's life because just the day before, he had gone to Mississippi to campaign for Mitt Romney. He's never been political in his 53 years of living, and he felt like it was time for him to get involved. And he talked about why he thinks Mitt Romney's the guy to lead this nation and why he thinks most Americans need to come off the tit. So here he is, my friend, Jeff Foxworthy. Jeff Foxworthy, ladies and gentlemen. And we're sitting on the stage at the Atlanta Punchline, and it's where you started your comedy career.
3 feet from us, right there. It was the first place I ever did comedy.
This stage is one of the happiest places on earth that I've ever found.
Yeah, it's my favorite comedy club in the country.
Do you, so you left a really nice paying job at IBM to start comedy. So don't you think, like, one of the problems America's having right now is our really top-end businesses are losing their
are losing their best sales. People to comedy. Yeah, it's not a normal path. But you know what? I think I was like a lot of people. I had no idea what I wanted to do in life. I was working in a grocery store. Oh, hell, I was happy as a clam. I had a little beer money and had some buddies to go out with. But my dad worked at IBM, and I think he called one of his buddies and goes, "My kid's working in a grocery store. Will you please give him a job?" And so
it wasn't like, "Oh, this is the smartest guy at Georgia Tech. We've got to hustle him in here."
No, Tech invited.
We've got a kid in Korea, and we got Jeff Fox.
No, I was. And IBM sounds glamorous. I carried a tool bag and I fixed machines. That's what I did. I was the guy that was always doing impersonations of the boss in the break room and always getting caught at it. So, you know, it wasn't like a stellar advancement path for me. But I had buddies that used to come in here every week, and they would come back to work and they go, "Fox, you're as funny as those people up there. You need to go try this." And they had a contest here, the Great Southeastern Laugh Off, and it was like 8 weeks, you know, and then they did it like bracketology. And they signed me up for it. Well, it was for working comics. It wasn't like an amateur night. And I'm like, "Crap, you guys signed me up." I'd never been to a comedy club. I came and sat right over there and watched 1 week. And I went home and wrote material about my family. And I came back and I won the week. In fact, an interesting story. My wife used to act. And she had just done a crappy movie. And one of the guys in it was a comic. He was in the contest that night. So she and a bunch of people from the movie came to root for him. She was here the first night I ever did comedy.
Oh.
So I met my wife in my career.
Oh, but you didn't know her. You met her. You actually met her.
She came up and talked.
Yeah, oh, wow. So comedy and the Atlanta Punchline gave you everything.
Yeah,
you
everything I have in life. Just my career and my wife. So, yeah. I mean, that was a pretty interesting
night. You've had a successful marriage. I've never read anything in the paper.
27 years.
Choking her out.
27
Country
years.
Music Awards.
No, We're pretty boring. We actually still like each other after 27 years.
I always thought that was cool because when I met you, you were wildly in love with your wife.
Still am.
And still are.
27 years, man. Which I didn't believe was possible. You know, my dad was married 6 times. He stayed wildly in love for about 45 minutes, and then it was on to the next one. So I didn't know you could do that.
But in comedy, I think that's really, you know, it's difficult. There's a lot of obstacles.
It's hard.
Especially when you get a little fame and...
Well, I think the hardest part was the early days because you're not making any money. You know, I went back and looked. The first 8 years I did stand-up, I did over 500 shows a year. And I found the book from the first year, the little calendar where you write your thing.
Yeah, I still have money, too, yeah.
$8,300 I made for, you know, however how many shows it was, $8,300. So you're gone every day, and you're making
for 500 shows. That's what.
Yeah.
The second month,
I made $20 doing comedy. So I mean, that was, and that was for one night here, like on a Monday night, I made $20 for the month. And so you're on the road. It takes a strong person. And she was just capable. I mean, you know, I'd call home at night from wherever I was, and she's like, yeah, the hot water heater blew up today. And I'm like, oh, my God. She goes, no, I got a new one. The guy came in and installed it. And, I mean, she could just handle stuff. And you – we've known people that were really funny.
Yeah.
That were married to somebody that couldn't handle stuff, and they had to get off the road. I mean, they finally had to go, you know what? She can't handle it. I gotta go do something else.
Right. No, that's why I waited so long before I got married. Yeah. I never had found the girl who could roll with it.
It's a strange life.
Well, and especially in the 80s, you know, when we started, there was like, God, it was such a wild time in America. Just lots of casual sex. I mean, I think it's probably happening now, but comedy.
Now it's
and,
the eighth grade. Wasn't going on when you and I were growing up. But. Yeah. Yeah, but it was a wild time. It was a looser time. And, it, you know, I think the advantage I had was I had watched my dad blow up six marriages. And I knew I was capable of it because I like women a lot.
Who doesn't like the squishy stuff?
Yeah, but I knew she was special, and I knew, like, guys would always say, hey, come on, let's go have one drink. Well, hell, I don't think you're going to hell for a drink. I like a drink. But I knew if I got in a bar and I had one drink, and then I had two, and then I had five, and somebody leaned over and started smelling good and looking good, I knew what I was capable of, and it was like, you know what, this ain't worth it. Because if I do that, I'm going to mess up this. And I know that because I've seen my dad do it 100 times. And so I think when you come from something, you either end up like it, or you learn from it. You learn from it, and you end up 180 degrees from it.
Well, and it wasn't that long after you started the Atlanta Punchline. I don't know what it was, 2 or 3 years that I met you. Yeah. Doing these really crappy one-nighters in Florida, and you know, you were always a really upstanding human being. You weren't like the scummy tail chaser, you know. But it's remarkable because when I started on those one-nighters, the guys that I worked with the most on those crappy Florida one-nighters were you and Brian Regan.
Yeah,
and neither one of you did really filthy shows. I remember, and I know you remember one terrible joke I used to do, and I'll tell you the one joke that I remember that you used to do, it was hilarious. I mean, it's not risque, but it was, you know, men, when they're making love to their woman, they think that, you know, that you look all smooth, but we really look like this, and you had this shaggy hair, and you would, like, mess it up, and you'd make this silly face. It was hilarious.
Yeah, well, haven't you? But every guy's done that.
But it's so true.
When you had sex in the morning, then you walk to the bathroom, and you're like, she just did it with this. She'll do it with anybody. I can't trust her anymore.
I thought that was hilarious.
And you ever notice this, too? Like, single people always have the best sex stories, too, don't they? And we know this because they share them with everybody. You know somebody like this. You see them in the break room at work, you know, saying things like, so there I was, tied up to her bed, had motor oil smeared all over my body. She came in the bedroom with a saddle and a set of jumper cables. See, married people just can't compete with this, you know? It's like, what are we gonna come back with? Well, you know, last night, Marge was vacuuming in her good robe. She bent down to get underneath the sofa. I thought, hell, I can watch Bonanza anytime. But I love being married. I found out something from being married. Girls, sometimes you'll ask us guys questions, and there's not a right answer we can possibly give you. My wife will say this to me, honey, I want you to tell me if I start getting fat. Always go, all right, you tell me if I start getting retarded. Well, don't even ask this, girl. See, men like to sleep indoors, all right? There's not a guy in his right mind gonna tell his girl she's getting fat. Your girl can weigh 3,000 pounds. You'd be going, you got a real tight butt, Tundra, I swear you do. But at least women worry about this.
And you and I met, it was Holland and Harris.
That's exactly right.
Gigs.
Yeah. What were you, because I'm trying to think what I would have made a night doing those. Maybe a couple hundred bucks.
You probably made a couple hundred bucks. I made, I think, $50 or $75
a
night.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a lot of money. And you were driving everywhere. I mean, you just do one night, drive to the next one.
Well, you were driving. I didn't have a car.
Well, I could give you a ride.
So. And we met, and we did this tour. And I remember, I think we did it twice together. The Foxfire Lounge in Lakeland.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you remember that?
I still have a book of matches from that
place. Of course you do.
Yeah. I swear to God, I did.
They had a great logo.
Fox's head, and I was Foxworthy, so I still have the book of matches from the Foxfire Lounge.
But I thought
you did the joke.
Go ahead, tell the joke.
You loved their slogan. It was Bush Beer.
Bush Beer.
Head for the mountains. And you're like, I'll make that exchange. Head for the mountains? Sure, why not?
That's such an open mic or beginning comedian joke. It's like,
but look,
the last time I saw you, you told me that.
It's been 25 years. It's been 25 years, and it's still in a file up here.
I was wounded when you told me that last time. I was, oh, God, didn't he remember anything? But I guess.
But why does your brain, I mean, that's probably why the fifth grader show worked, is you sit there and think, why does your brain hold on to that kind of stuff?
But I also think it's why young comedians should never go to New York or L.A. or London before you're ready, because people remember you when you're a young comedian before you are seasoned and have quality jokes.
I agree with you. I agree. You know, it's... That sticks in your mind. I mean, and it doesn't matter who you are. If you go,
and that's why you didn't ask me to do the Redneck Tour. I'm kidding.
now I'm feeling terrible.
No, I'm joking. I love you to death. But no, I want to say you were like, I thought you were the coolest guy in the world. You had these white Reebok high tops. Which, come on, in 1986, that was the coolest shoe you could possibly wear.
And they were very white.
I think they were really expensive. They were like $100 or something.
They were like, yeah.
And I worked with you, and I thought you were the coolest guy. And the very next week, I went out and bought a pair of white high-top Reeboks.
See, I have influence.
You did.
Oh, that's so funny.
But we had a great time. You had this baseball board game that you played with your brother.
Yes.
And you and I played
it.
Long ball. Is that the name of it? I've always wondered what the name of that was. And you showed me, you said, you know, it's interesting that you brought that with you on the road. And I love baseball. And I was fresh out of high school when I played baseball. And I thought that was really cool that we played this baseball game.
But you didn't have any money. I mean, see, and it was, you know, it was before video games. You had to have a way to amuse yourself because we had a lot of hours to kill during the day.
Right.
So mine was this stupid dice base. I can't believe you remember that.
I do. We played it for hours and hours.
Yeah.
And then back then I was doing these one-nighters and I didn't have a car. And I would hitchhike to gigs. And you gave me, I remember you had those little, what was it? God, it was a hot little Nissan XR.
It was
X28 or whatever.
It was a 280Z.
That was it, 280Z, which was a really cool ass car.
Yeah,
and you gave me a ride, and you know you were really nice, and you were you were an elder comedian to me, and you know I asked you all the young dopey comedian kid questions, you know, how do you get in with the Atlanta Punchline and things like that, and I was really into baseball cards, and I remember I gave you baseball cards because I didn't have enough money to give you for gas.
Remember that. Wow.
You remember that,
right?
Do
you want them back?
No. I remember, but I remember on the last day, like when I slid them under your hotel door and I left you a little thank you.
Yeah, you did. I remember that. They were in a little plastic sleeve there. And I was like, that's pretty cool because I didn't want anything. I thought, that's a cool guy.
Yeah, so
I still got them, too.
Were any of those cards...
I sold one of them for $3 million. Do you not know that?
Oh, yeah. That Honus Wagner card.
$3 million I got for that thing, man. You know what? They're still... They're in a little binder.
I still have my massive baseball card collection.
I mean, because you're probably like me. My mom threw all mine away from when I was a little kid. She threw away. I would never have had to work. They were worth, you know, $1 billion. And so when you were on the road, I mean, that was something you could do back then. Every little town had a baseball card store. You could go in there and look at the cards and, you know, buy a few cheap ones.
Yeah, before the industry kind of got screwed by collectors.
Yeah, it was
kind
of cool back then because it was before it really got... You know, it's like anything. It's once it gets too big, it's they ruin it. Yeah, it's like NASCAR. You know, when NASCAR was smaller, it was cool and it was hip, and then it got to be corporate, and then you're like, oh, you just kind of took all the fun out of it.
Are you saying NASCAR's not as cool as it used to be?
I am saying NASCAR's not as cool as it used to be. It's too corporate now.
Really?
They won't let anybody be a bad guy. That used to be the fun of it. Is yeah, the good guys and the bad
like
guys.
Like wrestling, really?
Yeah, exactly. It was a lot like wrestling.
Because I never got into it. I never got into NASCAR.
Well, and you had these small tracks in these places that nothing, you know, Darlington, nothing else went on there the rest of the year. It was a big deal. And, you know, they get rid of stuff like that, and then they...
So you had bad guy drivers out there taunting the, oh, yeah. I'm coming for you, Jeff Gordon.
That's why Dale Earnhardt was so popular, is he didn't take crap off anybody. Drove a black car, you know, he was the black hat, and you either loved him or hated him. And they kind of, they were like, no, you can't do that anymore. And
I always thought NASCAR was like just total for hayseeds. And my brother took me to the 2007 Daytona 500. And I don't care how you feel about NASCAR. That first time those cars and those engines go ripping past you, you're a fan.
You get a little once shot of testosterone right
Yeah, once
your
you
spine,
feel your innards yeah. get rattled by yeah. those cars. Excuse me. And then that race ended. There was like a penalty flag or whatever, a wreck, like with three laps to go. And so all the cars were bunched up together. And then right at the end, there was this massive, like, nine-car wreck. And it was like neck-to-neck finish. And one of the cars, I think it was like the third or fourth place car, crossed the finish line upside down on fire.
That's a good finish, yeah.
If you'd have seen it in a movie, you'd have went, oh, this is total horseshit. Yeah, yeah. That would never happen in real life.
I remember, you know, back in those days we're talking about, Vic Henley used to do a joke about that. You want to see the wreck, because you sit there and go, you know what, my life's a piece of crap, but he's on fire. You know, I got it made. He's on fire. You do want to see the wreck. I love the bad guy. I love the guy that would put somebody in the wall and wouldn't get penalized for it. You know, you love him or hate him.
So what about the Atlanta Braves? You haven't lost your love for the Braves, have you?
You know what? It's
are they too corporate?
It's funny because I never missed a game, and like now I never see a game. But it's like because your life kind of evolves. You know, then I didn't have other stuff to fill that time, and now I got kids and, you know, all kind of other stuff that I'm interested in. And I mean, I still like it when I watch it, but it's not the all-consuming thing that it used to be.
Right.
And you do get to a point, it hopefully as a man, you know, in your teens and your 20s, you kind of live and die with this stuff. Hopefully at some point you realize, you know what, whether they win the World Series or finish last, it really doesn't affect my life one way or the other. I still got to get up and go to work tomorrow, you know. So, yeah, I don't live and die with it like I used to. I mean, I still enjoy it, but it's not the... I used to want to drive.
So you're not
up
playing
a
long ball with your daughters?
No, I'm not playing long ball. No, no matter.
They've probably never even seen that.
My house full of girls. Long ball is buried deep in a drawer somewhere.
I did see a Montreal Festival gala set. I think 3 or 4 years ago. You know what the great thing about in Europe and in Australia, different parts of the world, is those Montreal gala sets are cut up and they're aired on like Saturday night. And I was in Holland. I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, and I saw your set from the Montreal Gala, and you were talking about your daughters and your wife and your brother. You guys live on the same alcove,
oh, yeah.
or something, and it was this bit about all this female testosterone that you're surrounded. And I thought, and I loved your set, and I thought it was really unlike, you know, I mean, I don't know, people who don't know you or aren't in the business might think, oh, okay, here's a guy who's just going to be ripping a bunch of redneck one-liners. And I thought it was a really great set that you did. Yeah. And I'm sitting in Amsterdam going, hey, you know, I used to have the same white Reeboks you did.
Yeah, you know what's funny about my career is if that's probably, I mean, I will forever be the redneck guy. At the height of it, I mean, when it was new and it was at its most popular, it was 5 minutes out of a two-hour show. And it didn't dawn on me for a long time. And somebody brought it up one day in the interview. They said, well, they're one-liners. And I went, oh, crap, you're right. And we live in an age where nobody does one-liners. But so they were easy to remember. They were easy to retell. All you had to do was remember one line and you could get a laugh. But I really think of myself kind of more of a storyteller as a comic than a one-liner guy. I mean, I sit there and tell a story about going on a family vacation or whatever. And so it's interesting, kind of the thing that defines me as a comic is not really the way I think of myself as a comic. But
that's just the mass media, you know.
Well, I don't think
the blue collar thing. You weren't out there just doing one liners.
No, I didn't do any written. I may have done some in the encore if somebody asked, but and we probably discussed this kind of stuff on those drives through Florida in the 280Z. But it's like everybody's different, and the thing. I mean, I still look back at it. I think as a comic, when you find whatever way it is that you come up with stuff, because I can remember being an amateur in here and watching commercials and looking at billboards and thinking, what am I going to talk about? And real early on, it just kind of struck me, okay, if I think something, or my wife says something, or my relatives do something, or my kids, we're not the only ones. And I just trusted that. And that's always worked for me. So it kind of eliminated where you looked or how you looked for material. And my life became, you know, note cards in the back pocket, just going, okay, well, if I'm thinking that my wife really likes to talk a lot more than I do, then I ain't the only guy feeling this way. And I just trusted that. And for me, that's the thing that worked.
Well, but you think you're redneck one-liners, though. I do think you did a remarkable thing. Like Rodney Dangerfield one-liners and, you know, Henny Youngman. I mean, you came up with, you know, how many comedians can come up with an industry of one-liners?
Well, and I wish I could say that I was smart enough that's what I was deliberately doing. I mean, it was in response to, I mean, I always wore jeans and boots. I always had a truck, you know, but I would get into comedy and I would start traveling around the country and they would sit there and go, oh, Foxworthy, you're nothing but a redneck from Georgia. I'm like, hell, I know that. I just found in traveling, I'm like, crap, it ain't just a Georgia thing. It's everywhere you go. And I was working in Michigan, playing a club there. And we're sitting there at the bar after the show one night. And they start picking on me about being a redneck. And the club we're playing in is attached to a bowling alley that has valet parking. And I remember going, come look out. If you don't think you have rednecks in Michigan, look out the window. People are valet parking at the bowling alley. And I went back to the room. We've done it a million times. And you're just trying to have something to talk about new the next night. And I wrote, you know, that was the premise. I know what I am, but a lot of people don't. Wrote 10 ways to tell. Went and tried them out the next night. And, you know, 7 out of the 10 they laughed at, and half of them they were pointing at each other. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, there's something here. And so let me go try to write some more. And
So it just started as a 5-minute hunk.
You know what? And to this day, I still write stuff on yellow notepads. My wife, several years ago, found the piece of paper that I wrote the first 10 on. It was an old crumpled up yellow sheet of paper, and she framed it, and it's by the front door in the house. And so here you got this nice house with this old crumpled up yellow sheet of paper.
paper paid for that house.
Well, and I said to her, you're gonna put this up? She said, it paid for the house.
Right.
You know, yeah, I'm putting it up.
I came up with a test to help people out. Things like, if you own a home that is mobile and 14 cars that aren't, you might be a redneck. If the most common phrase heard in your house is, somebody go jiggle the handle, you might be a redneck. If you've been married 3 times and still have the same in-laws, you might be a redneck. If your lawn furniture used to be your living room furniture, you might be a redneck. If your dog passes gas and you claim it, you might be a redneck. If your wife has ever said, come move this transmission so I can take a bath, you might be a redneck. If your grandmother can properly execute the sleeper hold, you might be a redneck. If your underwear doubles as your bathing suit, a little finger pointing going on now, If you own a Waffle House credit card, you might be a redneck. If you refer to your wife and your mother-in-law as dual airbags, you might be a redneck. If you've ever been accused of lying through your tooth, you might be a redneck. If you think the nutcracker is something you did off the high dive, you might be a redneck. If you've ever had hot flashes at a cattle auction, you might be a redneck. If you wear a dress that is strapless with a bra that isn't, you might be a redneck. If somebody hollers hoedown and your girlfriend hits the floor,
we will see you down the road. Take care of yourself. Good night. God bless.
But I always did work at it. I mean, I always did write. And so 10 of them got a laugh. And I thought, okay, if I can write 10, can I write 100? And then before you knew it, I had a couple of hundred of them. And I started sending it to publishers. And I can remember being on the road in those comedy condos and guys going, that's stupid.
Right. There's always some comedian to tell you, that's a stupid idea.
That's, you know. Oh, I remember one guy pulling me outside in New York and going, hey, that redneck stuff, seriously, don't do that. It's not going to fly.
But, I mean, even now, I think you could put out books forever.
I still do the Page a Day calendar. I did the first Page a Day calendar in 1990. It's 22 years later. I'm still doing them.
What's Page a Day? Where, like, there's
redneck
a different
jokes,
redneck joke every
different
day.
Redneck joke every day. And every year I'm thinking, there cannot be 365 more of these.
So every year it's different?
Yeah, just sit there and keep writing them. And I'm like, this is literally the bottomless pit.
It'll sell forever.
There's no end to this.
So let's take a jump to your sitcom. Yeah, we'll just cover this briefly. I mean, because, you know, you got completely screwed on your first thing. I mean, I think I might have saw one or two episodes. Well, you were on CBS, and you weren't even from Georgia. You were like, they had you in Indiana. Which, you know, there's nothing wrong with Indiana, but you're not from Indiana.
I remember saying to them, why am I in Indiana? And they said, well, we don't want the show to be too Southern. And I said, have you heard me talk? Has anybody here heard me talk? I'll tell you the thing, Tom. I never got into this with the idea that it was a springboard to TV or movies. I got into this because I love this. When I was a kid, I would save my allowance and buy Cosby records, and then later on Carlin and Pryor. And I just was always fascinated by stand-up. I remember being a little kid, and my parents would watch The Tonight Show. And I can remember having that door cracked and peeking through that door to watch the comics. I didn't give a crap about the actors or anybody else, but if Lonesome George Goble or Rodney Dangerfield or Bubba, I wanted to watch the comics. So I was always fascinated. So when I got into this, it wasn't thinking, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, Eddie Murphy, Adam Sandler, a lot of people got into this because that was what they wanted to do. It's a great springboard for it. I didn't give a crap if I ever did TV. So when I got a TV show, I was doing a show at the Wiltern Theater in L.A., and somebody came up and said, would you like a sitcom? And I'm like, okay.
You're slapping God in the face if you said no.
Yeah, exactly. And then I got into it. Well, they didn't even want to let me in the writing room, and they got me living somewhere else. And as soon as I did it, I was like, man, this was not a good call. I shouldn't have done this. You know, they didn't want to let me write. And I said, but do you understand I've been writing for myself, I mean, at that point, for 12 years.
Right. Well, nobody knows what you're talking about more than I do.
Yeah.
Because, so then you go to NBC, and your show was right before mine. And I don't know why she has it in her head, but my mother thinks my show didn't work out because you were a weak lead-in. Could you just say, I'm sorry, Sarah?
Sarah, I cannot apologize more. And By the way, your instincts are correct. We were a weak lead-in. It's not his fault.
No, but it was the exact same thing that you described. They wouldn't let... I'd walk into the writer's room, and they'd all be... They'd be quiet like I was the enemy.
But I never felt like they let you be you.
Exactly. And then I watched yours, and I'm like, that's not the Jeff I know.
Right.
And you're... it's funny. And then so here's two guys that were playing at the Foxfire Lounge in Lakeland. And I thought it was cool that you were on 8 o'clock on Mondays and I was on 8:30 on NBC. The Peacock that gave us SNL and Carson and Letterman and all these great comedies and Cheers and The Cosby Show. And
let me stop you there. I'll tell you something interesting. Because Cosby was always my hero when I was a kid. I bought every record he did. But I'd never met him. During that time period, I'm playing, I don't know, Bally's or somewhere in Vegas. And, you know, you're staying in the same hotel, so they change your name. They don't let everybody that's there call you in your room. I got a call from the operator, and she said, hey, I know you got a block on your phone, but Bill Cosby's on the line for you. And I'm like, yeah, right. This is my brother. Or this, you know, it's Bill Cosby ain't calling me. And I'm like, okay, put him through. And it was like, got his name up on the sign. Used to be below the prime rib, now he got the big letter. And I'm like, crap, my brother does a pretty good Bill Cosby. Well, it was Bill Cosby. Here's the interesting thing. You'll remember this. He was on opposite us. He was on the same night, but on a different network. And he called me to tell me, he goes, man, they're not letting you be you. You got to go in that writing room and you got to... And I thought, that's a love a stand-up has for another stand-up. Yeah. Because I'm his competition and he's frustrated that they're not letting me be me. I'm like, wow, really? You know, you're trying to help me out. And if I'm successful, it's probably going to cost you. But he was like, no, man, they'll run over. You got to go. And I thought, that's one of the coolest things in the world.
That's amazing. And, you know, I always thought... It was really kind of a candy-ass thing to do where, like, you read about actors or comedians where they throw a tantrum on the set and they kick over the water cooler. But now, in retrospect, I wish I'd have kicked over the water cooler and said, hey, guys!
What don't you fucking understand? You got any fucking idea about, hey, it's fucking distracting having somebody walking up behind Bryce in the middle of the fucking scene? Give me a fucking answer! What don't you get about it?
I was looking at the light.
Oh, good for you. And how was it? I hope it was fucking good because it's useless now, isn't it? Stay off the fucking set, man. For fuck's sake. Right, let's go again. Let's not take a fucking minute. Let's go again. And let's not have you fucking walking in. You don't fucking understand what it's like working with actors. That's what that is. That's what that is, man. I'm telling you. I'm not asking. I'm telling you. You wouldn't have done that otherwise.
No, what it is looking at the light and making sure that
I want to fucking kick your fucking ass. You don't shut up for a second, all right? I'm going to go. Do you want me to go fucking trash your lights? Do you want me to fucking trash them? Then why are you trashing my scene? You are trashing my scene. You do it one more fucking time, and I ain't walking on this set if you're still hired.
I look back at that part of my life, and I say it's my fault. I should have been more forceful, which is not really my nature.
Well, I think you and I both have a problem with politeness, and I think maybe we might have trusted.
I did. I trusted.
And I thought, hey, NBC, what? They know comedy?
But that was what they would say to you. But I say, yeah, but I write for myself. But Jeff, this is television. Like it was something different.
Right.
You know, and the people that it worked for, like Seinfeld, Jerry got to do his show. It was Jerry. That's why it worked, you know? And looking back, I loved the people, but it was a life-consuming job. I mean, it was most of your week being there. It started early in the morning. I mean, when you're starring on the thing, you're there early.
You don't go home at night.
Yeah, until you're there working on it. And at the time, I had little kids, and it was the most frustrating thing I had ever done. Because I just felt like, I mean, I'd read the script and go, crap, this isn't even funny, and I wouldn't say that. It was just frustrating. So when they canceled it, I tried to act like I was sad. I literally I hung up the phone. I was like, yes,
I'm free.
Yes, thank
free
you
at last.
God.
Free at last.
Yeah. So and you know the funny thing is I thought, well, I don't like television. Years down the road, do blue collar TV where it's sketch.
And you can do whatever you want.
And I could I could walk in and say, hey, I want to weigh 400 pounds and have Elvis sideburns, and they're like, great, let's do it.
Yeah.
I love doing that. Loved doing that. And I was like, okay, I don't hate TV. I just hated being the Jeff Foxworthy somebody else thought Jeff Foxworthy was.
Right.
I guess I don't like playing myself, you know. I don't know.
No, I mean I completely relate to what you're saying, you know. And I also never wanted a sitcom, and all I wanted to be was a comedian. And my high school baseball coach used to always say, you should never be trying to hit a home run. A home run should be the accident of a line drive.
Yeah.
And that's how I got that sitcom. I was just smacking the crap out of the ball. And then all they saw was the hair. And, hey, cream rinse. Hey, Fabio. How many Fabio jokes can a man withstand?
Yeah.
So I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, you and I were, you know, we could have been the greatest powerhouse.
It's my fault, sir. It's still my fault.
I talked to my mom last night, and she goes, don't you dare.
I have no animosity about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, because I would watch it. Crap, this is not funny. And it's funny if I went back and did it again. It's like that. Like they made me the boss. And I'm like, crap, I shouldn't be the boss. I should be the redneck guy at the workplace.
Doing the imitations and getting caught.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the boss doesn't get to be funny, you know? Think about Andy Griffith. Andy didn't get to be funny. Barney was funny.
Yeah. Well, that's it. If I ever did another sitcom, I wouldn't, because when you're the star, you have to carry the plot like an albatross from scene to scene. The second banana comes in, joke, 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 exit.
Boom. And they're going home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. Well, and here was the frustrating thing. I would pour all this time into this thing and was frustrated all day long. We'd film on Friday night. Saturday night, I'd fly somewhere and do a stand-up show. I was making three times for the stand-up show what I was making for the sitcom, and I was talking about the stuff I wanted to talk about. And I finally got to the point that it was like, this is nuts. This is nuts. I hate this other job, and it's paying me a third what my favorite job is. I was thrilled when it went away.
So what have been your greatest triumphs in comedy? Like the Bill Cosby story, Bill Cosby calling you, like things like that.
That's
just
cool.
As you know, comedian to comedian, not money gigs or TV gigs, but just like the what have been your most cherished moments as a comedian.
One above all else, the first time doing Johnny Carson. And it's like even people that are young don't understand this because you've got 1,000 TV channels. You know, we had three. We had three. And so for a comedian, that was the top of Mount Everest is if Johnny Carson liked you. And that was all I ever wanted to do. In fact, I've got a black and white photo, and I'm sitting in the chair talking to Johnny, and Johnny's laughing. And even now I walk past and go, crap, that's all I ever wanted to do.
I made Johnny laugh. His career is a success.
But here's the thing. You had 6 minutes. And they were, man, they would tell you, when we say six, we're not talking about 5:50 and we're not talking about 6:10. It's 6 minutes. You better do 6 minutes. And you know how hard it is to, because you got to kind of take pieces of things to put together a TV set.
But to do a 5-minute television set is like doing an Olympic dive.
Absolutely.
You got to hit it with very little splash and just perfectly go through the water.
Well, I went around town for a week doing that 6 minutes. I had it down to 6 minutes. I'm behind the curtain. It opens up. I walk out there. Second joke, I get an applause break. I'm smiling. My brain, every alarm in it is going off, going, stop, because you're messing my 6 minutes up. Do another joke, get an applause break. Now I'm smiling and talking, but my brain is 3 minutes ahead of me going, okay, 3 minutes from now, you're doing 4 jokes about your dad. Out of the four, the third one is the weakest joke. Go ahead and cut that out right now. So you're smiling and talking, but your brain is editing. Every time there's an applause break, I'm thinking, this is messing my 6 minutes up. And I was, a guy had given me advice. He said, have one last joke that you know how long it lasts. And mine was like 30 seconds. So I told the guy behind the camera, I said, tell me when I'm at 5 minutes. And then when I'm at 5:30, do that. because I knew that gave me 30 seconds to adjust to get to that last joke. So you're sitting there calm and smiling and going through this, and it is the biggest mania your brain can ever experience. I mean, it's just exhausting. And I get to the thing at 5, and I correct and cut a line here and drop a tag and whatever, and get to 5:30, and when it fit, I was like, you know, you're smiling, thank you, and your brain is like, ah, oh my God. Well, then you're scared to look because you've been on the road playing crap clubs every night for the past 5 years. And Caesar sits over there and decides whether you live or die. And I'm scared to look. I'm like, crap, I can't look. You know, and I looked over and he was waving me over to the chair. And so that little 6 minutes, I remember going home that night and laying in the bed and staring at the ceiling going, I don't have a plan. That was my plan. That's all I ever wanted to do. You know,
what do I do with my life now?
I mean, really, it was like, where do you go from here? Johnny laughed. You made Johnny laugh. Where do you go from here? And people wouldn't understand that now, but that was a big deal because you were set. I mean, it was almost like being in the mafia. You were a made man.
Yeah.
You knew you were going to work if Johnny liked you.
And I did the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and it didn't have as much impact.
Well,
but I know what you're saying, because I also used to, when I was a kid, I would highlight the TV guide of what nights comedians were on Carson and on Letterman.
Yeah.
And I would just stay up and watch the, and I thought that was the most important thing in the world.
And then when you started doing this for a living, you know, it didn't matter if you were MCing or Midland, when guys you had worked with were on it, you were watching it.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember working here, opening for Rich Scheidner, and then Scheidner's going to be on The Tonight Show, and man, I'm glued to the TV. I mean, just glued, because it was almost, you know, there was part of you like, well, if they can do it, maybe I can do this one day. Because I know that guy. I worked with that guy. I ate Cheerios with that guy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So that would be the best moment. That'd be the best moment. Another cool moment, when I lived in L.A., we got invited one night. Alan King had a book signing at somebody's house. And can't remember the guy's name, a movie producer, but my wife's a big movie buff. And we never went anywhere. I mean, we were little kids, and she's like, I want to go to this. And it was like Jerry Bruckheimer's house or something. And so we go, and Alan King's in the foyer when you come in. And, hey, thanks for coming. He goes, I got some guys hanging out in the backyard. He said, go make yourself at home. Well, I walk out in the backyard, and there's Sid Caesar, there's Buddy Hackett, there's Milton Berle, there's Billy Crystal. It's like the who's who of comedy in the backyard. And I remember standing at the sliding glass door going, holy crap. Holy crap. And Buddy Hackett comes over to me. He's like, hey, Jeff Foxworthy, I introduce you to my wife. And I was like, you're smiling and your brain's going, Buddy Hackett knows my name. Wow. And so we visit for a few minutes and he goes, have you met Milton? I said, no, sir, I never met Milton. You got to meet Milton. So he's got his arm around me, and Milton's holding court over there, you know, in the patio. And got about 10 guys around him, and Buddy walks up with his arm around me. He goes, Milton, I want you to meet Jeff Foxworthy. And Milton stops talking, and he turns around and looks, and he goes, oh, my God. He goes, I am such a giant fan of your work. And I kind of, like, shuffled my feet and looked at the ground. I said, thank you very much, sir. He goes, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about Buddy Hackett. And everybody out there went, ah! And you're thinking, how many times have they done this? How many times have they done this to somebody?
Slowing up. He takes vitamin E and his wife takes iron pills. So when he's ready, she's rusty. Jimmy, look at me, baby, please. You should be very proud tonight. Look at all these great stars who showed up in your honor. Mickey Rooney, who still looks like the boy next door to the motion picture home. Now, there's LaWanda Page, very talented, and she's very big in real estate. She moves into rich neighborhoods and starts ghettos. Jesse Whitey, I mean White. Sorry, LaWanda told me to say it that way. Tony Randall who always has an expression on his face like he's smelling a gas leak. Henry Fonda. Oh, beautiful. Remember, Henry, when you were 21 and you were matinee idol? Today, one matinee and he's idol for a month. George Burns, what a lover. His pacemaker is acting up, though. Every time he sneezes, his garage door opens. I want to ask you, why is everybody picking on Jimmy Carter? He hasn't done anything.
That's awesome. Alan King used to have a show on the Disney Channel when cable first came on, and him and Steve Allen and Buddy Hackett and these older comedians sat around a round table and talked about the old... Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
And it was the funniest thing. I've always remembered Steve Allen was telling a story, and Alan King cuts him off. And Steve Allen goes, oh, I stand corrected. And then again, I should. I'm wearing orthopedic shoes. So what has been the greatest comedy advice anybody ever gave you?
I've never been asked that question. You know what I remember? I remember early on here, sitting on the curb outside the door, Leno was playing here for the weekend, and somehow we found out that Leno was making $4,000 for the long weekend. And we were like,
that's a fortune.
We were like, he's funny. Nobody's that funny. Nobody is that funny. But Leno was always generous in that he would talk to the new guys. I mean, he would always tell you what he knew. And I remember being at a Waffle House down the street early, and he said, your goal should be to write 1 new minute a week. You won't do it, but that should be your goal. And I remember thinking, are you kidding me? I can write 20 or 30 minutes a week. Well, he was right. I mean, in my best years when I was writing like a maniac, I might come up with 45, 50 new minutes if I was lucky. And so it was just how valuable a joke was, you know. And he used to argue with me. He said, I don't know why you do those records, because you put them out, then you gotta write all new stuff, you know. And maybe he was right, maybe he wasn't, but...
That's right, because there was that series of truck stop tapes that I remember.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, you know...
That was a good deal.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because I know you got screwed on it, because I was playing here at the Atlanta Punchline, and it was like, you know, right after the Blue Collar Tour really exploded, and I was at this gas station right around the corner here, and they had a friggin' its own cardboard stand... Of Jeff Foxworthy cassettes, and
that was that was a guy who was making truck stop tapes. The deal was he'd give you $2,500 for every half hour of material, and I did an hour and a half, and I got $7,500. No residuals. You just got the one night. Yeah, but hell, I thought I am ripping this guy off. I think he only sold like 2 million of them, you know. So.
Yeah. But like those Comedy Central specials, they do the same thing. You get they give you a flat thing, and then they air it forever. Though, I mean, when you're a comedian who hasn't gotten to a certain level, how do you avoid that scenario? You really can't, can you?
I don't think you can. I mean, because you.
You it's know, almost like the old blues guys, you know. Here's $5,000 and a bottle of whiskey. Give me 10 songs.
Well, and for a comic, people, all you want is somebody to know your name. And I remember thinking people had to hear your name 50 times. And that's where the redneck jokes came in handy, because it was something to slap at. Oh, that's that guy. That guy's the redneck guy. But I remember being in L.A. and doing morning radio, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and doing like 12 or 15 interviews, one after the other, sitting there smoking a pack of cigarettes at 4 in the morning to stay awake.
Oh, my God. You used to smoke. I remember.
Oh, yeah.
I totally forgot
18
that.
Years without a cigarette. So, But it was like, because they didn't remember it the first time and the second. And that's all you wanted, was somebody to remember your name. Because that's how you sold tickets, which is how you made more money here.
Right.
You know, and so. But when you're starting out, you'll do anything. I mean,
but it's funny, like you
in
said.
The same situation, I'd do the truck stop tapes again. Right. I remember the guy telling me, he goes, your only problem is you're not dirty enough. Can you throw a few cuss words in there? So I'm throwing cuss words in that don't even fit into the joke, you know? And,
But like you said, hey, you felt like you were ripping the guy off.
Oh, yeah. $7,500 bucks? Are you kidding me? Yeah, I thought that was a great deal. So, you know, you the people that endure, you learn at some point the business of it. And it's show business, and everybody likes the show part. But you've known a lot of guys that were
some
of the funniest people I've ever met were never successful because they never understood the business part. They love the show part. But, you know, but they're chasing waitresses and smoking dope all night, and they never did the business part, the work of it. And so I learned to do the business part of it. Still love the show part, but, you know, I remember James Gregory one time selling T-shirts back in the back, and you're sitting there going, crap, you've just done a show, and now you're selling T-shirts? And James said, you're there anyway. Why not make another $100? And I thought, well, yeah, you're making $100 a night, five nights. You're making 500 more bucks than I am a week, you know?
Yeah, the amazing thing James Gregory did before everyone had computers was he had a mailing list. He would get people's addresses and physically mail them with a stamp.
I'm coming to town.
I'm coming to your town.
And he had a little thing, the funniest man in America, you know? I mean, he created a moniker for himself. I mean, you know, and that's how he was built, the funniest man in America. Well, there was no contest. There was no voting.
Right, right.
He just, you know, it was smart business. He just dubbed himself the funniest man in America.
Machiavellian. He crowned himself.
Exactly.
Yes. So what joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
Huh.
Like, I really liked that hunk I saw you do in Montreal. But, I mean, that, you know, because it was about your family.
You know,
and I thought it was really telling. And it's... you know, it could have been anybody.
Well, you know, they're funny because they're like your kids. They're like your kids. And then when you've been doing this for a long time, it's almost like a baseball team. You've got the guys that always start, and you got the guys that sit on the bench. And I always imagine like a curtain in your brain, you know, and the regulars are going out, and the rest of them are just sitting there on the couch watching TV, and the guys at the curtain going, joke about cremating your grandmother. Come up here, you know. And he's like, oh, crap, I'm on tonight. But it's hard to pick. They're your kids, you know. I don't know that I could pick a favorite one. And I don't know how you feel about yourself. I could never watch myself or listen to myself.
What do you mean, now or through the years?
Even now I hate it. I
really?
Mean, that just had a special air with Bill and Larry the Cable Guy this weekend, and people were like, oh man, that thing was good. And I was like, I'll never watch it. I can't stand to watch myself. I can't stand to listen to myself. I remember doing the Tonight Show, and you'd do it in the afternoon and come home, you know, you go to dinner and it's on that night, and my wife would be watching it, and I would be like in the other room just like, and she's like, it's good, come on. And like, so I don't know. I mean, I'm probably not a fair judge. I'll tell you a funny story. I was doing a corporate gig about 10 years ago, flying a private plane down somewhere. Well, Ron White was my opening act. And they hardly ever do this on a corporate gig, but they requested like a couple of specific bits that were on my first album. Well, I didn't remember them all the way. So on the way to the airport, I grab the CD and I throw it in the CD player. Well, I'm listening to it just to kind of refresh it for me. And I pull up outside the airport, and there's Ron sitting out there on the bench smoking a cigarette. And I pull up front, and I said, Tater, I said, they wanted a couple of bits from this first album, and I just listened to it. There's some funny shit on that album. And Ron goes, thus the Learjet. But, you know, I can't watch monitors. Sometimes I can go back and look at, like I was in here not long ago, and Steve Mitchell was playing me the Atlanta Comedy Classic that we did 25 years, the 25th anniversary of it. And I'm watching myself, you know, part of me's laughing and part of me's just rolled up in a ball looking at this mullet, you know, weighing 140 with the white Reeboks on up there and just cringing at the jokes, you know.
In the 80s, everybody made fashion mistakes. But you've been, so the punchline is 30 this year. So you must have been here from like the first year it started.
Or the second, yeah, it was real early. It was a new thing. It was booming, man. It was, and I think you're like this. While I do it for a living, I was always a fan of it.
Yeah.
Because I can remember being home and I wouldn't even be working that night, but to come watch somebody else and just sit in the back and watch them, and just go, crap, that guy's funny. I'll never be that funny.
I love it. You got to study the masters. I'm obsessed with it still to this day. And I like being the elder now. When I was the young dopey kid asking you questions, now when I see a young dopey kid, I'm perfectly patient with him, and he's asking me all these questions because I remember being that guy, and it's the cycle.
You're the mentor now, you know, and it's. I don't know about you. I never thought I would be doing it this long. You know, if you think about it, it's not a career of longevity. Most people, if they do it, they're hot for, you know, a few years and you go away. And so I remember thinking when I quit my job at IBM, I hope I'm able to do this for 2 years. That was my thought. If I could do this for 2 years, then when I'm 60, I got something to talk about the 2 years I was a comedian. And I figured I'd go back with my hat in my hand and ask for my job back. And so now when I go, holy crap, I've been doing this almost 30 years. If I was at IBM, I'd have the gold watch. You know, they'd be pushing me out the door.
Yeah.
So, but I'm with you. I like, you know, when somebody, you can just see it in their eyes and they want to do it and they don't know how to do it. And it's, you know, I sit there, okay, write everything down. Put a pad next to your bed. Put a pad outside. I don't know about you. I've written 50% of what I've ever written in the shower. I got a pad on my bathroom counter to this day. And I come out and write, because I've learned if I don't write it down, I'm not going to remember it.
Yeah. And keep getting on stage until you break through that fear, you know?
Yeah, man, to where you just... I remember sitting in the green room backstage at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, listening to Gary Shandling, Seinfeld, and Leno breaking down jokes. Well, for me, it was like a kid sitting in a PhD class, you know? Nah, green's funnier than blue. No, Jay, blue's funnier. But listen to him, just condense it. And I think I'm more fascinated with it now than I was 30 years ago, because you realize there's a lot of musicians. There's a lot of actors. There's very few people that make standing up here holding this microphone their life's work.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's funny.
Or can have longevity, you know?
We were all competitive back then, you know? It's like a bunch of rats trying to scramble out of the box. But I think when you get down the road, and it's probably the reason that Cosby called me, is you have a kindred spirit. At least I do. I don't feel any competitiveness with anybody anymore. It's like, you know, the first Blue Collar tour, I was the headliner because I was the guy people knew. Well, after Larry blew up, I was like, Larry, you close the show. I don't care. I don't have to close the show. I'll go first. I don't care. But now when I run into people that I was on the road with, there's this affection because...
It's almost like your Vietnam War buddy. You know, we went through this thing together.
Because
you know.
I know where you came from. That you know what this feels like.
Yeah.
I know that you know... You know, it's like Leno said one time, you'll slog through an hour of stuff to get that one new joke. And if it works, if the new joke works... Your night's made.
Yeah. Oh my God, but there's no greater feeling than when you have a new joke in your set, and like three jokes before, I'm thinking, oh my, I can't wait to get to the
joke. Here it comes, yeah. And then you throw it out there for the very first time, and they laugh, and you're like, holy crap, got a new one for the lineup.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I love that you say that because, you know, I know how hard you worked. I was there with you. I saw these crappy gigs, you know, and I think the rising tide lifts all ships. That's the way I've always felt about comedy. And how similar are comedians working with comedians to working with children on the...
Well, the kids, the 10-year-olds of fifth grader may be... It's funny, they're not nervous.
Really?
You know, they're in front of a live TV audience with all these bright lights shining. They're not one bit nervous. I can remember those early days just being petrified.
Yeah. You know?
And that's what you're talking about, getting over that fear. Because when you're a good comic, you just look them in the eye. And it gets to the point, it doesn't matter what you do. You can't shake me. I remember one night, and I'm sure you played the Punchline in Jacksonville.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I remember one night on stage there. It's the only time it's ever happened. It was a great room. I used to watch The Simpsons every Sunday night before the show. But I don't know why I remember that. It was the new show, The Simpsons. But right in the middle of the set, it's the only time I've ever had the thought, I thought, what makes me think that what I have to say is more important than these other 300 people in here. And it was almost like a miniature panic attack. And I'm like, you can't think about that. Just keep talking. But it's a weird job. You're thinking what you have to say is more important than anybody else. And in a way it is, because you've spent so much time in preparation on it. You've worked at it.
I've never had a problem with that. You're right. But no, that Jacksonville room was great, and the owners had Porsches parked out front, and then they moved the room to a bigger location.
That's always never that little greed. We can make 100 more bucks.
So what have you learned from the, you might be smarter than a fifth grader? Is there any knowledge nugget or epiphanies that, or even just trivia? What?
You know what's funny about it is, I guess the great thing about being human is you can always change your mind. Because if you had asked me 15 years ago, would you ever host a game show, I'd have laughed at you. I love doing fifth grader. I mean, we didn't get renewed this year,
Sorry.
But I got to kind of be me. And it's funny, when they presented the idea, you know, Mark Burnett said, all right, got an idea of adults taking an elementary school test for a shot at $1 million. And I said to him, crap, I wish I'd have thought of that, because in its simplicity, that's brilliant. Because right off the bat, everybody thinks, I can do that. You quickly find out you can. I can remember the head for the mountains joke. I can't remember anything about triangles. But I got to be still, I got to be funny. I got to kind of mess with people. And so that was different than a sitcom. I liked it because it showed kids in a positive light. And
yeah,
all you ever hear is bad stuff about kids. And so I thought that was cool.
In the educational system in America, I think.
Lord have mercy.
I think there are a lot of children that are smarter than your average adult.
But it was kind of one of those things, never say you wouldn't do something, because I never thought I would have done that. And I'm sad that it went away. I mean, we did it for 5 years, which is a good little run in TV.
I thought it was fantastic. I didn't know that they didn't renew it. And there's certainly nothing wrong with hosting a quiz show, because... Well, not that his is a quiz show, but I was just in Seattle last October, and, you know, Drew Carey, you know, that's what's so great about comedy. It's a really small business, you know, and you stay friends with people forever. He's hosting The Price is Right. Yeah. He owns the Seattle Sounders soccer team.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in the owner's box with Drew, and we did, like, comedy on the road. That it was one of my first television appearances, that Showtime show, and I've been friends with Drew forever, and like you, he's the same guy essentially, but he owns a soccer team, and we're sitting in his owner's booth.
And to me,
can I have another prawn sandwich, please?
That's the coolest thing you could say about a guy. See, like I think Larry the Cable Guy's the same guy.
Yeah,
and it's, you sit there and look and go, oh my God, this guy's made $100 million, and he's still. That's cool, you know. I did a gig at an army base in North Carolina last year, and the guy, we were driving to the thing, and he said, you won't remember this, but you did this gig 25 years ago, and I drove you then. And I was like,
wow,
you know. And then we were driving back that night, he said, oh, by the way, he said, you're exactly the same guy. I said, nothing you could say would please me more. That's cool. Because it's kind of hard to gauge yourself sometimes, you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, you life gets weird, you know, I mean. My goal in this, when I started, I thought, crap, if I can make $100,000 in this, hell, I never envisioned TV shows or books or, you know, whatever. I mean, it went way beyond anything I ever thought it would do.
But I'm glad you say that, because, I mean, you know, it's funny sitting here with you now on the stage at the Atlanta Punchline. You're basically the same guy you were driving around in that 280 ZX.
Hair's just a little shorter, mustache.
And we're just talking
gray.
About comedy. We just, you know, we're a little more seasoned.
But here's the cool thing. All these years later, you still love it.
Yeah.
And I love it, too. And you know, as a fan of it, here's the deal. It's like when we decided to do the Blue Collars tour, the promoters of the show were thinking, we need a big ending for this. And I thought about it, and I thought about it. And I thought, okay, as a fan of comedy, I remember sitting on my grandmother's bed and watching the Carol Burnett show. And what I used to love about that show was you could tell how much they liked each other, and their favorite thing was to make each other laugh. And I thought, you know what, if you're a comic and you do your job right, you don't laugh. You keep a straight face. You tell the things. But people, like we talked about, like to see behind the curtain. Just why don't we just pull out stools and just sit here and laugh with each other, you know? And I think for most people, that was their favorite part of the
show. You know what? I'm glad that was the most memorable thing for me when you guys were sitting there on the stools just...
Because there's a thing, and it's hard to even say this because I'm part of that group now, but for me, anybody that made me laugh, I have a warm spot in my heart for them.
This is great. I feel like I'm home. I am, I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, originally. You from Atlanta? No? We've seen Georgia on the map. It's purple. Actually, I was just back there. You know, everywhere you go in Georgia now, all they talk about is the Olympics coming there in 96. And, you know, my whole thought is the Olympics in Georgia. God, you know we're going to screw that up. I guarantee you, when they let those doves go at the opening ceremony, there are going to be guys in the parking lot with shotguns. And we will not have a flame that big without a pig on it, I guarantee it. Some fat guy going, dang good barbecue top of them stairs up there. They ain't got no handrail, be careful. Hell, the Olympic rings will be 5 old tires nailed together. Because they burn a long time. I'm going back to see this. I mean, if nothing else, the opening ceremony. Greetings, y'all! And welcome all you dang foreigners from other nations. Dear Lord, be with our guests and prepare them for the butt whooping they are about to receive. I'd be doing the high jump over a clothesline. And this here clothesline was donated by Ray and Faylene Walker. Faylene done got her an electric dryer. I'm telling you, instead of discus throwing, they'll be flinging Ford hubcaps. We're all gonna help Earl clean his junkyard out. Come on down. See, that's my fear. They're going to get the list of events. They're going to have no idea what half this stuff is supposed to be. They'll probably have to cancel water polo after the first 2 or 3 horses drown. Like for fencing, they'll be giving people baling wire and sheet metal. You boys, see if you can hem this goat in. Ready? Go. And the hammer throw, can't you see that? All right, hit your thumb as hard as you can, and then chunk it. If you don't cuss, it don't count. I think since we got them in Georgia, we should change the games just to make us look better. Like instead of the 4x4 relay, do the 2x4 relay. That's where you and your buddy take your truck to a construction site at 3 in the morning to improve your home at discount prices. Some of us have played that one. And you know, they hadn't even thought about it, but the river they're doing the kayak racing on is the same river they filmed Deliverance at. That ought to add a whole degree of difficulty, shouldn't it? Because if Ned Beatty couldn't make it down that thing, a Frenchman in a pair of bicycle pants ain't got a chance.
I'm still that way. You know, I remember doing fifth grader, and we were doing the celebrity thing. People were playing charity, and Vicki Lawrence came on, and that's all I wanted to talk to her about was that show. You know, and she would talk about... that they would rehearse it for 3 days and rehearse it the same way every time, and then they'd bring the audience in and they'd go to film it, and Tim Conway would do something totally different than what they had rehearsed because he knew it would make Harvey laugh, and that's all he really cared about. And I remember laughing at Harvey trying not to laugh. I mean, that was funny. So, and so now for people to say to me, I've been listening to you since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I remember being a little kid and we'd go on vacation and my dad would put your tapes in the thing. They're like, oh, wow. So I guess I got a space somewhere inside of your heart, you know, because I made you laugh sometimes.
Yeah, you do. Isn't that remarkable that you,
yeah,
people revere you the way you might have revered Carson?
It's just weird. I mean, no one.
Because you've been such a part of people's lives growing up. And I love the thing I heard you say about, you know, the Blue Collar Tour, that, you know, you're tired of these executives in Los Angeles and New York, you know, that thought they knew what they, the whole, they call them the flyovers, which, what an insult to refer to our entire country as the flyovers.
Absolutely.
The people you fly over.
And don't you think for what we do, I look back at it, one of the coolest byproducts of it is I've been to all 50 states.
Yeah.
And very few people can say that. I know what this country's like. I know what they're like in Wisconsin, and I know what they're like in Idaho, and I know what they're like in Vermont because I've been there. And the scenery changes and the accents change. People are pretty much just people, but that used to insult me. I remember being in a meeting one time in LA and the guy had on like a velvet jacket and a cashmere turtleneck and two earrings in and his hair slicked back, and we're sitting in the meeting and the guy looks at me and he goes, Jeff, I know your people. And I laughed. I said, my people would beat the hell out of you. It's like, you have no idea who my people, because you don't know anything in between. I know them. I've done this night after night after night. And, you know, it's funny. It's like people in the media centers, if they're ever sitting there reading a bio, and they'll stop and they go, you've sold more comedy records than anybody in history? And I'm like, yeah. It's not Cosby. It's not Carlin. It's not Pryor. No.
Like they don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe it.
But, and somebody said one time, do you think that makes you the funniest person? I said, God, no. Not. But I had a wide audience. And because I did it the way I did it, if you were listening to me and your aunt and uncle walked in the room, you didn't have to turn it off, you know. So, but it was because of those flyover states. I wasn't hip. I just kind of saw a piece of everybody's life, I guess.
Right. Well, I think you're accessibly American. I think, and you are a guy who, you're quintessentially American in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, guy from Georgia, loves baseball, comedy, and
his wife, his kids, his, you know, even his, you know, my community. It's like I sit there, I mean, crap, I'm involved. I want to be involved.
But now, speaking of getting involved, we were supposed to do this chat yesterday, and then you text me and say, I got to go to Mississippi for the campaign, and I'm thinking, oh, God, please don't let it be for Rick Santorum. And, whew, you were stumping for Romney.
Yeah, well, you know what, and it's funny.
And then you're from Georgia, and I had another sneaking fear. I'm like, maybe it was Newt.
Yeah, you know, it's
why now? If you,
it's funny. I've never been in 53 years. I've avoided it, and deliberately avoided it. I can remember being early on watching political comedians and thinking, dude, you're pissing off half the audience.
Right.
Whatever side you're on, you're half the audience doesn't like you. I want to make everybody laugh. You know what? And one of the byproducts of this is when you get to meet people that have served in the military, and they get a kick out of meeting you. And that's always...
Yeah, I've done these gigs around the world, and they're always, oh, my God, they're so grateful you're there.
And it's embarrassing to me, and I'm sitting there thinking, dude, you're putting your life on the line. You've given up a leg. You've given up an arm. All I do is tell fart jokes, you know. And I thought that the other day, because I'd gotten to the point, and I did, you know, wherever you stand politically, and I said this, if you had a household and you were spending more money than you made, you'd go bankrupt. You'd lose everything you had. Well, the same thing with a nation, which is what we're doing. And I think we're way overspending. And I think it's like a bus headed for a cliff. And if we don't stop, my kids and their kids aren't going to grow up in the same place I grew up with. And I finally went, you know what? I'm not comfortable with this, but if there's people willing to give up their leg for this or their life, I can give up being out of my comfort zone a little bit. And I mean, I was just urging people to vote, and like, this is a business, you know. If you hired somebody to run your business, and 3.5 years later your business was in worse shape, and not only that, but you had doubled the amount of debt you were in, you'd fire that person that was running your business. We can't continue this way. And it just, you know, it got to the point, it was like, you know what, lay them on the table, and everybody's not going to agree with you, but that's the beauty of living here, is you can say what you think. That's the beauty of doing stand-up, you can say what you think. And it was like, all right, here's my opinion. And I told him, I said, it's not an emotional decision, because emotional decisions get you in trouble. I've thought this out. I read the paper front to back every day. I've really thought this out, and here's
what you think. Romney's the guy to lead the country?
I think he's the best option. I think he's a businessman, and I think it's going to hurt a little bit, because we've gotten spoiled, and you can't keep living above your means. You know, if you ever want to get your household budget, you ever listen to Dave Ramsey at night, he's like, okay, sell the BMW and drive the clunker and eat ramen noodles for a year. But when you hear these people, then they finally get out of debt 2 years down the road, and he goes, is it worth it? And I go, oh man, yes, absolutely. And we got to do that for our kids. I mean, it's...
Well, my mother is a staunch Republican. And last night when I told her that we were supposed to talk yesterday, but you had to go to Mississippi and campaign for Romney, she said, I totally forgive him for the sitcom thing.
And I'm Sarah. We're back good again. That's cool.
But you know, my family's Christian. I know you're Christian. What is, and I've been following the campaign, and it's like Romney should have had this locked up, the nomination, a long time ago, but it seems like Christians are just weirded out by the Mormon thing. Yeah, why do you think that is?
Well, it's funny. I am a Christian, but why is I don't know. You know, it's like anything. It's like a lot of prejudice comes from not being exposed to something
or not knowing.
You know, it's like where I grew up. It's like I never met anybody Jewish growing up, and then you go to New York and you're like, oh wow. And but exposure dissolves a lot of prejudice. You know, and where we live, I mean, you don't know anybody Mormon here. But I've worked a ton in Utah. I've worked, and it's like, man, I walk away from working with, or I went bow hunting in a place in southern Utah with a Mormon family, and I walked away going, man, what a cool family. These guys just love on each other. They're so nice to each other. I wish every family could be like that. So it's exposure. And here's the deal. If I was electing a pastor, that might bother me. But I'm not. The United States government's the biggest business in the world. I want a businessman running that. And even if you don't agree with his religion, you look at his life. He's been married to the same woman for 40 years. He's a man of character. You know, the people that are around him that are saying, I talked to a guy in Salt Lake that worked on the Olympic thing, and he said, we were $300 million in debt. When we pulled him into this, and he said, and he walked in, he looked at it, and he goes, okay, no more private jets, no more town cars, no more lease cars, no more five-star lunches. We're ordering in pizza every day. Roll up your sleeves. And they went from being $300 million in debt, and they finished with a $100 million surplus. And you're like, you know what? That's what our country needs. They need somebody to roll up their sleeves and go, okay, no more of this. No more in the middle of an economic crisis, the president taking Air Force One and going to Hawaii for 2 weeks and eating at a five-star restaurant every night. Are you kidding me? You don't do that when you're broke. You wouldn't do it in your house.
Well, one thing I noticed that there was a thing I had read in the paper a couple weeks ago or a month ago about how none of the candidates had a sense of humor. Like Reagan, they were comparing like how Reagan was so lovable, and then like you see, then the next thing you see of Mitt Romney, he's cracking jokes.
He's trying, but that's but, but I'm not electing a comic, you
right.
know.
I mean, right. But then and then he comes to the South for the primaries, and then for Georgia, howdy y'all, he comes out. Am I saying this right? And I had some cheese grits.
Yeah, you know? He's trying. You know, he's trying to be one of the guys. He's not one of the guys. But I tell you a thing. Yesterday morning
So tell me about Mississippi.
So we're speaking in a place. It's a restaurant. On the inside of it, at all the tables, there's all the local political people. We're supposed to speak outside. There's a grandstand. There's a little thing set up. So I do the Fox Good Morning, whatever the Good Morning show is. You know, satellite. Governor Romney does it. We're supposed to go outside to speak. Well, as I'm walking to the door in this crowded room, a guy hands me a raincoat. I said, what's that for? He goes, it's pouring out there. Governor Romney's behind me. They give him a raincoat. They hand me a microphone, and my first question was, am I going to get electrocuted? I mean, that's what I worried about, because it's pouring. He's right behind me. He walks out the door and he looks at it. And he said, no, 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 no. He told the Secret Service guy, take down the barrier. And he went out to the stands and he got those people out of the stands. He said, come in out of the rain. And he pulled them under the overhang of this restaurant. And it was just everybody packed in there. And he found a bench and he stood up on the bench and he talked to them out there. And I thought, you know what, in a microcosm, here's a guy that walked out and saw a problem, immediately made a decision on how to fix the problem. And he was compassionate. It's like, I'm not going to stand up here and talk while you sit in the rain. And I thought, that's just a natural born leader. He didn't have to discuss it. Hey, would it be okay if we, you know, the Secret Service was freaking out because he's got people 2 feet from him just crammed around.
So did you go with him around the whole state? Or
no,
did you
we
just
did the thing
appearance?
In the morning and then we split up and I went away and, you know, did my thing for him and he did his thing.
Because I thought it was interesting. You know, I'm waking up and having coffee, watching CNN like I normally do, and comedian Foxworthy is in there. It's my buddy.
It's amazing to me. I told my wife last night, I said, it's amazing to me that that's even a big deal, you know, that I would do that. And I don't think I'm wrong.
Do you think our country would be in trouble if we don't elect Mitt Romney?
Honestly, yeah. I think we're headed towards economic disaster. I think we're like that car getting way close to the edge. And if you go back, I'm kind of like history a little bit. But when you read about when civilizations, like the Roman civilization, which the Roman Empire, what made it fall apart? It was because people became so dependent on the government that the government couldn't afford the people. It's like an animal that has a parasite. If you don't treat the parasite, it will kill the host eventually. And that's, you know, we've just gotten too used to that. And it's, I don't know, man, when we became an entitlement society, I don't know when, you know.
Haven't we always been, though?
Well,
ever since World War II,
it's all of our fault. We've just slowly, it wasn't a 90-degree turn. We've just slowly done this and expect more and more and more.
But we stopped making the best televisions and the best cars and the best, you know, I don't know.
You're right. We became complacent. We got fat and happy.
When we became consumers instead of producers.
Yeah, we became fat and happy. It's our fault. I mean, but we got to pay the price for it. Or, I mean, we got to eat the ramen noodles. Or it's not going to, America's not going to be what it has been. It's scary when you start to think we're now how much we're paying in interest out of what we make. I mean, if it was a household and you took it to a financial planner or whatever, he would go, whoa, 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 dude, you're headed for the poorhouse.
Okay, so what could you tell an undecided person about Mitt Romney that would make them vote for him?
You know, well, he fixes broken businesses. That's what he does. I don't like politics. I certainly don't like big government. I was listening last week, and the president said something, and somebody said, well, what would you want for everybody? And he said, well, I would hope that one day everybody could own their own house and they could put their kids through college and hopefully put aside a little for retirement. And I was listening to that, and I was thinking, really, is that what the American dream has become? Because that's just kind of getting by. Is that really what the American dream is? Because to me, the American dream, there wasn't any guarantees, but it was living in a place where you had the opportunity. And I'm the American dream. I grew up with a dirt yard and one toilet in the house. I made millions of dollars doing something I love. God, shouldn't I feel guilty about that? But it's like when he said that, it was like kind of capped in a little box. And I thought, no, the American dream is if you bust your ass, the sky's the limit. There is no limit in what you can achieve. And that's sad that we've lost that. It's sad. You know, the thing I'm most disappointed about in the president was when he ran, he talked about being a unifying guy, and I just think he's totally divisive. It's the haves versus the have-nots. It's the 99 versus the 1%. And I'm like, boy, since when should people be ashamed for becoming successful? I mean, it's like trying to make me ashamed for being successful. And I'm like, you know what? I know I'm blessed. I know I got a blessed life. Like, crap, I made a boatload of money doing something I love to do. But I always work my butt off, and I've always given a ton of it away. My wife and I put 10 kids through college right now. One of them's mine. Nobody, I mean, I ain't saying that for nothing. It's just, but but to me, I'm blessed to be able to do that. You know what I mean? So for me, being successful doesn't mean I don't have 50 cars. Do I have a nice house? Yeah, I got a nice house. But for me now, the joy is being able to do stuff for other people. You know, we went over to Kenya and just saw, we built a safe house within a the biggest slum in the world there for kids that both parents died with AIDS. That's a joy. That's a joy to do that. And you shouldn't be ashamed of that. You shouldn't be ashamed of being successful.
Not at all. No. And you've had a beautiful life. I think that the Republican Party is really in disarray.
It is in disarray.
And they've been so nasty with each other. I think they've given the Democrats a lot of ammunition when the big election does roll around.
They have. And that was part of my reason for going out yesterday, because last week was Super Tuesday here. And actually Newt Gingrich had an ad, and it said, it's time to choose. And I thought, you know what, you're exactly right. It is, because all we're doing is tearing each other down, and we're spending money that could be better spent in the fall election instead of having to spend it against each other. And so,
right, and Romney had nasty billboards all over Florida against Newt.
Oh yeah, it's just nasty. It's like, stop.
Stop, yeah, just
stop. It's like your kids arguing with you. Stop.
Have you ever thought about running for political office?
No, I would have no interest in that.
Not at all. Not even governor of Georgia.
It's funny, because now people...
Because I'm thinking about how... I mean, me personally, I and that's why I asked you, what could you tell an undecided person about Romney? Because, I mean, I don't think any of these Republican guys...
But you know what? It's interesting.
And I'm sitting here talking to you going, I would vote for you.
it was funny yesterday, because we were sitting backstage, and they were talking about having discussed if there was an inauguration... You know, Obama spent $105 million on his inauguration. And the people in the Romney camp said, yeah, we were talking about that. We wouldn't even do a ball. It's like, save the American public $100 million right there.
Wow.
And I said, you know what? If you did that, people would say, I'll follow you. You know, he's talking about, I ain't taking a vacation.
What is your attitude to what you're saying? Like he did in Salt Lake City. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's eat some pizza, have some ramen noodles. And find
a
solution.
That's what we got to do. That's what we got to do. And we've got to, hard as it is, come off the tit. You know, there's...
Off the tit.
There's a lot of
people... Now, there's your campaign slogan.
There's come off the tit. That'd be my bumper sticker.
Jeff Foxworthy, 2016.
Come off the tit.
Come off the tit. I would work the phones. I would work the call center.
That's a beautiful.
You know my friend Jeff Foxworthy.
Come off the tit.
He wants you to come off the tit.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, thanks for always being my friend. I really appreciate you giving me that ride in that 280Z.
Well, you know what I love? Just like I said, all these years later, we're still sitting in this joint, and we still love this thing that we do.
Yeah.
We're blessed guys. We made a living doing something we would have done for free.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
Thank you, God.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thanks, Jeff.
You bet.